All right, what's up, ladies and gentlemen? So, yes, my background is quite different. I am actually out in New York City. I am here for special event. I was invited at the last second, so here I am. I took the flight, came all the way in, and I said, the show must go on. The show must go on.
That's on Pink Floyd, The Wall. You know that?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Hey, come on, The Wall, you know.
I know, but is that where the line is from?
No, but I mean, we might have some people here who like Pink Floyd, so including myself. I saw them in concert in 87. Yeah, I don't remember a lot of it, but I remember enjoying it at the time.
Well, that's like Pink Floyd. Like, I don't know how people couldn't like Pink Floyd. And they're just one of the classic legendary rock bands of American history.
They're not American, but you know.
So, but English history, like, so America, UK, all that jazz, like, everybody worships Pink Floyd. Now, how does it feel that this is our last episode of the season? Can you believe it's already over?
You know, it seems like it went pretty quick. It reminds me of a Walking Dead season where you're like, is that it? It's already over? Hey, you know what? Well, I will criticize The Walking Dead, but I am still, and even though I haven't seen most of the episodes, in fact, the show is over, come to think of it, but I am going to order AMC Plus and I'm going to watch the remaining.
Okay, so I convinced you to watch all of it. Yeah.
Well, but listen, let me tell you this. Because our season is over, I am going to have more leisure time, but I am going to try to concentrate a little bit more on the writing aspect and try to get some stories on the Epic Times. I do have one in mind, but you know, it's, you know, it is kind of sad. I like doing this. I love doing this show. But now I'll be able to devote time to go see my mom and spend a little time resting and try to do a little bit more writing. So
we're going to have a few months off, you know, so it'll be nice. And hopefully now that because you were saying like, man, the season's already over and you're like, it's like The Walking Dead. Like, is that it? Well, hopefully when this episode ends and the season concludes, you don't sit back and be like, man, was that it? It wasn't even really that good. Sort of like you talk about The Walking Dead, because that show is trash now.
No, the difference is that I love doing the show with you, and but when I finish watching The Walking Dead, I'm pissed off because I'm irritated with the wokeness.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm glad at least I'm seeing the story. You know, it was like the three last Star Wars episodes. They were pure crap, but I had to watch them because I'm a Star Wars fan. What can I say? Yeah. But I'll never forgive what they did to Star Wars, kind of like what I'll never forgive how they ended The Walking Dead. But with our show, I am at least enjoying it, and there's nothing, I have no regrets.
Yeah. Well, no regrets. That's good to know. Ladies and gentlemen, here's something that you won't regret either: subscribing to our show. You can subscribe to us on our YouTube channel. You can also subscribe to us on wherever you're listening to on the podcast, Apple or Google or Spotify. What's cool about Spotify is they've allowed us to also put up our video. So you can actually, instead of just listening, you can also watch us on Spotify as well. And we're still on the Epic Times. The Epic Times releases each episode a few weeks after the original comes out. So it is what it is. But if you're on Epic Times and you're a fan of that, you can watch us there. Also, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, we're doing a lot of stuff over there. And you can visit us on our website, thesonsofhistory.com. You can check out our gear, all that jazz. Well, Christmas is coming up. This is the last episode of season four. And let me just go ahead and say this now, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you all have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, because, well, we won't be doing a show and you won't hear us say anything about it. Yeah. You want to get started with our guest, Dr. Allen?
Yeah, but before we do, I just wanted to say I hope you have a very Merry Christmas, and you know, but we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end of the show. But
yeah.
But I'm just, because I know me, I forget. So you may have to remind me, but
yeah, who knows, man? I'll have to write it in the notes.
Remind me before the show is over. So, but yes, I am looking forward to speaking to Steve Kirsch. I have a lot of questions I want to ask him. I've never had the opportunity to ask anyone about ancient Greece, ancient Persia. So I think this will be a good time. And having looked at his book, it's quite interesting. It's Herodotus and some of the other stories, but without the dullness. It's actually very, it's a page turner. You go to the next page. It's very good writing, very good writing style. I'm very much enjoy it. So
it's so great that we get connected with these writers. The publicist over at Pegasus Books reached out to us a while back about his book, and I was like, it would be a great way to end the season on ancient Greece.
Because it's a great disservice if we don't, you know, read these types of stories. And I've spoken to people who really didn't want to read Herodotus because of all the stuff in it. Well, now with Steve Kirschall's book, you have the opportunity to learn the history of how the things, you know, the Battle of Thermopylae, stuff like that, how it all came about. Now you have the chance to read it in a book that's quite enjoyable and very thorough.
Yeah, it's very thorough. And it's, like you said, it's not intimidating where you're trying to pick up Herodotus's book and you're like, I don't know if I can read this. But ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we're going to bring on Steve Kirschall on. He's incredibly accomplished. Just give you a rundown of who Steve Kirschall is. He is the editor of the Penguin Dictionary of Classical Mythology. He earned his PhD at Bristol University under the supervision of Professor Richard Buxton, who is one of the leading scholars on Greek mythology. Professor Kirschall currently teaches at the Oxford University Department for Continuing Education, and here are the books that he's put together. He's the author of Greek Myths and Legends, Tales of Heroes, Gods, and Monsters, Mythologica, Barbarians, Rebellion and Resistance to the Roman Empire, A Brief History of Atlantis, Plato's Ideal State, A Brief History of the Roman Empire, A Brief Guide to Classical Civilization, A Brief Guide to the Greek Myths, and the one we're primarily going to be talking about, is The Harvest of War, Marathon, Thermopylae, and Salamis, the epic battles that saved democracy, that came out here just recently. And it's a huge honor, and we're going to have a lot of fun talking to Steve, and we've got him on the line now. Steve, how are you?
I'm extremely well, thank you. Yes, wrapped up against the cold here in England, but apart from that, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Oh, beautiful. Where exactly are you in England?
I'm talking to you from just north of Oxford. So I'm based at Oxford in the university there, and I live in what you would think of perhaps as a typical English village in the countryside, with pubs and village greens and that kind of thing. So it's sort of slightly rural Oxfordshire is where I'm coming from.
Oh man, that sounds like a little bit of heaven right there.
It's good, actually. It's not a bad place to be. I could live in a lot of worse places, I'll tell you.
Hey, Alan. If you want to switch places, I'm in Houston and it is humid, and I mean, it's December and it's humid. So
it's December here and it's very cold.
We had Alan, where was Josiah located? We had a Georgetown professor. He's a professor of classics, Josiah Osgood. He was stationed out. Was it Oxford, Alan?
I think it was Oxford because I mentioned Cambridge. I mentioned that if he was going to visit the University of Cambridge also. But he was in the Oxford area.
Excellent.
He's good stuff too. He does the Roman classics.
Fantastic. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. So
we're gonna do the Greek one. So we are gonna call him by the real name, Heracles. We're not gonna use Hercules because that's Roman.
Absolutely.
And I don't like that. And I think there are a couple of other names, Ares, not Mars, and a few others. So
you bet. Yeah, we need the Greek side of things here.
Yes, we are. So all right, well, I'm gonna first thing that I wanted to ask you before we even get started in the discussion was that now you mentioned in your title of your book, you mentioned three very important battles, Marathon, Thermopylae, and Salamis. But I'm going to say this, instead of Thermopylae, if it was my book, I would have put Plataea because I found Plataea to be far more significant than Thermopylae. I found Thermopylae, although heroic, was a bump in the road. What say you? Because Athens did get burned regardless.
Absolutely so. And there's always room for debate here. And we like this. It's I think that you're absolutely right, is that the Plataea battle was the, if you like, the final nail in the Persian invasion. So it's indeed a victory for Sparta and their allies on land, and a very significant event in Greek history. I think that's true. But I rather like the idea that the Battle of Thermopylae, although it was, if you like, a heroic defeat for the Greeks, it had a crucial element in the whole process of the invasion, is that it's because it held up, partly because it held up the Persian invaders on a significant level. And it also, I think, gave the Greeks a psychological boost, despite the fact that they'd been defeated, or small number of them had been defeated in that heroic last stand, they'd in a way shown that they had the ability to resist the Persians in an effective way, even though on that particular occasion I think it was it didn't work out that way. So for sure, I mean, there's three battles in the title, but you get a ton of bonus battles in the whole thing, and we I guess we could have had Plataea there, but I think the significance of the Thermopylae, we know no Thermopylae, no Plataea, I think is
perhaps. Well, we're Texans, so we have the Battle of the Alamo, and then which was, you know, we held out about 10 days longer than Leonidas did, it was a bump in the road for Santa Anna, but it was at San Jacinto where he was annihilated. In Herodotus's The Histories, he states that there were possibly up to 5 million men in the entire force. I don't believe it, even though he stated that all the rivers were dried up because they drank everything. But what do you think was the real number?
I think getting to the heart of numbers is a really, really difficult thing in ancient history. And Herodotus is in a way quite amusing here, because the contingents of Persians who come bearing down on Greece come from every single different region of the Persian Empire. And Herodotus talks about the way that he calculates this, is that Xerxes himself, the king of Persia, doesn't really know how many men he's got. So he corrals a thousand of them into a pen and counts them all, and then sends them off, and he gets another load of people to fill the pen, and he keeps doing this. And I love the way that Herodotus presents this, because he talks about the number of troops who are present, and then he has to add in there's the sailors as well in the fleet, and there's the sort of the camp followers and the engineers and all the sort of extracurricular people and the concubines and what have you. And he goes on and on on this, and he calculates it quite specifically. And then almost like at the very end of it all, he says, well, actually, and then there's a ton of load more of that as well. And I've just completely lost count of this at this point. So I think without question, the numbers that we're presented here are way and above, far outstripping anything that's likely to have been moving into Greece. And as you say, you have this these stories of them drinking rivers dry and what have you, but it doesn't stack up. It's, I think, numbers, it's a thing that as an ancient historian you are constantly presented with as problematical. You know, there's in a sense, we perhaps can calculate more effectively on the Greek side, but where it comes to the Persians, I think we're talking extreme guesswork here. And so that's kind of just the way it is. We always struggle with numbers here, be it battle casualties, the troop numbers, that kind of thing. Very difficult to work out. And I think just finally, what Herodotus is trying to get across is just that Xerxes and the armies of the Persian Empire are just bearing down on Greece with overwhelming force. And I think that's what Xerxes himself feels, is that I deploy overwhelming force, no one will resist. And he gets it horribly wrong.
Do you think that some of it might have to do with like propaganda from Herodotus for the Greeks, but also the Persians using their force, like their force of numbers, as propaganda against potential enemies?
I think yes and yes to your question, to your questions there. I think, yeah, with Herodotus and the Greek sides, you know, the Herodotus talks to Greeks as well in order to write his history. So, and I think there's much there that's propagandized, is that the Greeks like to present themselves as a small number of defenders in the teeth of this sort of overwhelming, humongous, barbaric mass that's bearing down on them. But also, I think it could be from Xerxes's point of view, because one of his battle tactics, a strategic calls, I think, is simply, as I said before, just to deploy overwhelming force in the hope that no one will fight. Is that there are various conversations in Herodotus's histories where Xerxes is talking particularly to the exiled Spartan king Demaritus, and he keeps asking him, he says, you know, will these people fight me? And Demaritus says, yeah, they will. There's something special about them. They've got things that they will fight for. And Xerxes just laughs at him. He says, no, it can't be right. You know, I've got these overwhelming amounts of people. They fight under the lash. They do as they're told. How could anyone resist? And Demaritus says, well, the Greeks, they fight for their land. They fight for freedom. They fight for these ideals that you don't understand. And so I think there's a propaganda element on both sides, if you like. You know, Xerxes doesn't want to fight. You know, he doesn't want to fight. He just says, yeah, if I put all these soldiers in the field, no one will fight me. They'll just roll over.
But so, the way I was reading how Xerxes would do or the Persian kings would do things, was they would present these overwhelming numbers and really overwhelming odds of winning, like you're not going to win. Yeah. But at the same time, he presented such a favorable situation for whoever surrendered, so it seems, that he would give them like all this power as long as they knelt before him as their king. So from my perspective, it's like he doesn't think that people would be willing to fight because of the overwhelming numbers and the potential defeat, but also, why would you want to fight when you really don't have anything to lose except, to an extent, your sovereignty?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think what he underestimates, as you get from the various conversations that particularly Herodotus presents in his history, is that he's that's exactly what he thinks. But he just underestimates the Greeks. And the Greeks, there are various Greeks who keep, and indeed people on his own side, who keep telling him, no, you're wrong. This issue of sovereignty is a crucial thing. You don't understand this, that these Greeks will fight for their homeland, for their ideals. You know, there's and the Persian king how can they be unified? They're, you know, a load of them are Democrats. You know, they can't even agree amongst themselves. How will they do that? You know, they don't even obey each other. And it's interesting, I think, that Demaratus says, but yeah, there is one thing that they obey, and that's the law. They obey the law, and regardless, and they will fight and they will die and they will not run away. You just, you know, it's like, oh, great king, you just don't get these people. You know, you just don't understand them.
I found this as, like Alan was saying, the numbers don't seem believable. And you sort of made to the point, like, yeah, I wouldn't go with those numbers strictly. There was something, Atossa. How do you say her name? Darius.
Yeah, Atossa. Yeah.
So Darius's wife asks him to conquer Greece, and he agrees. Mm-hmm. Like that whole, like the bedtime, like laying in bed, that story. And she says, go conquer Greece because I want some Greek slaves.
Yeah.
How much stock do you put into that story as the start of it?
Not a great deal. I mean, it's a wonderful story. I think it's absolutely great, is that, you know, Darius is there. He's newly on the throne, and a new Persian king is going to have to assert his authority, I think. But I think this is something that Herodotus has imagined, because you know, all of a sudden in the history, it's wonderful. You have this sort of private access to the king's bedchamber, and the two of them are in bed together, and she's saying, come on, prove that you're a real man. You know. Mm-hmm. And she says, I've heard of all these amazing Greek slaves and Greek people from Corinth and Athens and Sparta. I want some of these people for my slaves. You know, go prove you're a man, conquer them. There is no way that Herodotus, you know, knows that is true. Quite where he doesn't tell us where he's accessed this information, but you can be absolutely sure that he doesn't have a private hotline to the king's bedchamber.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's how King Louis the 15th of France ended up going to war with England, because his wife and Empress of Austria, Maria Theresa, I think was her name, were like, come on, be a man, go to war with England. And he did. Absolutely. And he got his ass kicked.
Yeah, got a bit of history repeating itself there.
Yeah. So now I want to revert to the Greek weird freedom.
Yeah.
Now, how much of an anomaly was that?
In that sense, I mean, I suppose the context of these Persian invasions is that it's the democratic system at Athens, which is one of the great things that's at stake here, is relatively new. You know, it's taken, you know, maybe 100 years to evolve into the system that they have, but it's only in the last sort of 25 years before Darius comes into Greece that they've really crystallized a system of democratic government and accountability in Athens, and based on these ideas of equality of speech, equality of under the law, and sort of equality of status, there's crucial things that are incredibly important to them there. So the Greeks have this feeling of that we have something that's special. Our independence is something that's incredibly precious to us. You know, this is partly because of the way they live. I mean, they're not in a sense a unified nation state anyway. They live in individual city states, that are, when, if you've ever been to Greece, I mean, the geography of Greece is very mountainous. Towns are quite isolated from each other. So they live in these quite small, fiercely independent, autonomous communities. And they have that as a as part of their Greekness, if you like. But they also have it at a local level, with that they want to govern themselves. To be governed by someone else to them equals slavery. So I think it's as simple as that. So this is what they're about. That independence is crucial to them.
Now, was democracy only in Athens? Because and you can correct me on this one, because I had a discussion with Dustin on this. Now, I know Sparta would have two kings, five ephors or ephors.
Yeah.
And in the assemblies, it was the loudest who chanted who won the argument, not so much the numbers. Yeah. And I don't know what Thebes used. I don't know, Corinth, some of the other.
Yeah, it's at this stage in Greek history, there's a number of different political systems. Is that Athens has developed this democracy, and it's starting to make its presence felt in other states. Sparta is kind of a thing unto itself. As you say, it has two kings. It has these officials called the ephors, who are annually selected, almost like to keep an eye on the kings. And then it has a council of elders, which is a very small group of people who fundamentally keep the day-to-day running of the state going. And then you also have an assembly of the citizens, who have various voting rights and so on. And as you rightly say, some of their election procedures are utterly extraordinary. So they just lock the judges up in a hut where they can't see who's being elected and what's going on. And the people come forward, and the assembled people shout, and whoever gets the loudest cheer wins. Simple as that. It's a crazy system. Or maybe it's a very good system, I don't know. Whereas in Athens, you've also got, in addition to, if you like, democratic election, there are certain officers of state that are determined by lot, or a combination of election and lottery. So you simply, people put themselves forward for public office and draw lots for it. And whoever name comes out of the hat or the urn gets selected. Not interesting. It's for them, I think, that's kind of super democratic. You know, it's this idea that anyone, absolutely anyone within the state can perform sometimes quite high level public office is embedded in their thinking, I think. So you've got democratic Athenians, you've got curiously sort of hybrid constitution Spartans, and in many other states, they are essentially oligarchies. They're small groups of aristocrats or wealthy people who dominate power within their states, like they do at Thebes or Aegina and Corinth and various other states too.
So you've studied so much on ancient Greece. I'm sure the thought, and it may be the idea behind the book itself, I'm sure the thought has arisen that if Persia had won and wiped out the Greek armies, what would have happened to the idea of democracy? What are your thoughts on what would have happened to that very idea?
It's a really interesting idea. I think that early democracy at Athens was very fragile, very, very fragile. And in the first Persian invasion under Darius, their former tyrant, single ruler Hippias, was there with Darius, ready to be installed as a puppet ruler of Persia. So certainly I'm not sure about, I think there's a difference between maybe the idea of democracy that's out there. The genie is out of the bottle there. Mm-hmm. Pandora's box has been opened, but it's taken the Athenians such a long time to put this in place that without question that it would have been the structures of that political system would have been dismantled by the Persians. They would have installed their own puppet rulers, and the the sort of administrative thing they preferred was to install what the Greeks called a tyrant. Tyrant doesn't necessarily have to be tyrannical in the modern sense. It just is a, right, if you like, an unconstitutional ruler. But that would have been the, without question, the preferred Persian model. So it would have, I don't think it would necessarily have destroyed democracy, but the Athenian democratic system was a very peculiar and very specific way of organizing power within a state. And I think that, to be honest, that I think would have been dismantled. That was, you know, that someone else could have invented it again at some other point. But I think at this stage, very, very, it would have certainly set back, if you like, the cause of democracy for a long time.
Yeah. So to Alan's earlier point about Plataea, you've got Marathon, Thermopylae, and Salamis. Hmm. Another battle. How much does the importance of the sea battle of Artemisium get lost in everything?
That's a very good question, because it's almost like, as I read it, I think the battle of Thermopylae and Artemisium are almost like one battle. You know, you have the Spartans and others holding the pass at Thermopylae. You have the Athenians on land, and then you have the Athenians and others trying to block the narrow seaways not that far away. It's the Artemisium and Thermopylae are pretty close, and so the engagements, the naval side of it and the land side of it, are almost part of one battle. But I think the Artemisium battle is another crucial one, because it's a battle that the Greeks, particularly led by the Athenians, don't specifically win. That they, in the end, they have to withdraw, but they stall the Persians for long enough, and they create circumstances in which the Persians forces are severely diminished. The greatest destruction in the Artemisium campaign comes from the weather, to be honest. So the Artemisium battle is often sidelined. It's not a great, you know, heroic victory. It's a kind of holding operation in which principally the Athenians, but other Greeks are able to keep the Persians back and prevent them from intervening at Thermopylae. And again, I think what it shows the Greeks is it's a bit like it is at Thermopylae. I think it brings a feeling of self-confidence that this combination of the Greek attitude, the Greek expertise, I think, plus the nature of Greece, the geography, the weather conditions, the sea, that's fighting on the Greek side, very much so. You know, there's more to it than just Greek human beings here. There's the Greek landscape is at play as well, and I think they're harnessing that to their cause, and that they do that very much at both of those engagements, I think.
You know, I'm a descendant of Phoenicians, so I was going to see if you're going to say anything negative about my people. So I'm
I wouldn't dream of it.
I'm relieved of that. I'm relieved of that aspect of it.
It's many Greeks would. The poor old Phoenicians have a rough old time of it when it reputationally in the ancient world. They are kind of, well, synonymous, you know, with cheating and trickery and
you know, we were explorers. We weren't, conquerors, right? I don't think. Although,
yeah, one or two bits of conquest, but that's mainly in the Western Mediterranean. So, you know, Carthage is a Phoenician colony, and various goings on there. But they were great, great traders and explorers for sure.
Yeah, Queen Dido did a pretty smart thing with the bull. You know what? That's actually a question I wanted to ask you before I go to my next question is. Okay, so the Trojan War was estimated around 1200 BC. Mm-hmm. Now, the story, if you, I'm sure you've read the Aeneid, yep. Was you had Aeneas mm-hmm. escapes, and he shows up in Carthage, yep. But the timeline just doesn't add up. And I never, I mean, we're talking what?
Yeah, about 400
years.
Yeah, 400 years difference. Yeah,
400 years.
I think traditional date for the founding of Carthage is 810, is it? I think so. Yeah, so you've got 400 year difference. It's we often have to, as you got ancient historians and people who live in the world of Greek mythology. I think particularly when it comes to mythological chronology, it just doesn't happen. It makes no sense. It's not supposed to. And I think what's happened, that's a really interesting thing, I think. So the Trojan War happens mythologically. Aeneas comes mythologically from Troy to Italy via Carthage. And I think one of the things that Virgil has done is deliberately to fuzzy and that chronology so it allows, you know, Aeneas, the great leader of the refugees, to meet with the glamorous queen of Carthage on his way to found to found Rome, or to set in process the founding of Rome. But what of course he does is that the fact that Aeneas and Dido's relationship goes so horribly wrong in Virgil's mythology, if you like, creates the situation in which Rome and Carthage are going to be implacable enemies in the future. So he's kind of tracing his causes of that back to there, simply by, as you say, essentially violating the mythological chronology. So don't look for chronological coherence in the mythical world.
Well, okay, now, you know, Hollywood, I know Hollywood, they talk a lot about, there was a movie that came out in the 60s called The 300 Spartans. And then earlier in the century, you had 300. Now, they talk about the Spartans, but there were Thespians and there were Thebans that fought reluctantly. So why are the Thespians not given any credit for?
That's interesting. I think, again, it's the way that, you know, history is often appropriated by the victors, or in this case the losers, which is quite interesting. And yes, it's one of those things I think that those events were very quickly, if you like, almost like mythologized in after the battles within certainly the people that Herodotus was talking to. So yeah, there were a whole load of other contingents present at the Battle of Thermopylae, and but in a sense they've been edited out in favor of the sort of the special band of warriors who fought with Leonidas there. So I think it's the quirks of, if you like, almost history rewriting itself on that one. Yeah, there's far more to it than 300 Spartans. And there were, again, numbers is difficult game. Numbers game is always difficult. But it's those 300 Spartans who have, if you like, emerged from the story as the heroes of the event, the heroes of the hour. And again, possibly primarily because we access it through Herodotus, who's you know, and who talks about, you know, he went and visited Sparta. Someone told him the names of all 300 of them. Sadly, he didn't write them down. That would have been beautiful had he done so. But so I think it's a question of, you know, history is one of these things that's always like a work in progress. Almost, it's constantly being reinterpreted, rejigged, remodeled, reappropriated by people for all sorts of different reasons. So I think absolutely there's far more to the Battle of Thermopylae than 300 Spartans, but those are the ones who sort of get the kudos in the end. They're the ones who make it to the movies.
Now, I've never had the opportunity to ask an expert in this field. So since you're here, I'm going to ask you. There were two things that I've always wanted to know. Number one, King Croesus, was he executed by fire when he was conquered, or did he live on to be an advisor to and I don't know if it's pronounced Cyrus or Chorus.
Both. Cyrus is the anglicization of it. Kuros is how the Greeks would have called him. The latter, he ends up as an advisor.
He's up as an advisor. Okay. And the other one was the story of the Magi after Cambyses dies.
Yeah.
And Darius and his friends gather around to discuss, you know, whether, you know, we need to do a dictatorship, an oligarchy, or democracy, and some story about earlobes. It was that all, you know, he looked like, apparently one of the Magi looked like Cambyses or something like that, but they could tell by the earlobes.
There's always difficulties, the transitions between rulers in ancient Persia were always problematical. You know, there's always the new ruler has to assert himself. There's always quite a lot of aggro. And on this particular occasion, we have someone posing as someone else. So we have someone who's pretending that he's someone else who is in fact dead. And the way it's discovered was that this it was to do with the way they found out who was the real one and who wasn't was of his wife. It was grabbing hold of his ears while they were having sex, and one of them had ears and the other one hadn't because they'd been cut off. So it was it's a curious and convoluted sort of ways of doing it, but it's amazing how one can determine who the real ruler is as to whether they've got ears or not, and whether there's something for his wife to grab onto when they're having a nice time together.
Yeah, I thought back in those days they were supposed to lay on their back, close their eyes, and think of England.
Yeah, maybe they were in England, but not in Persia. They were. There's all sorts. So you need to read the book for this. There's all sorts of scurrilous filth about Persian bedroom habits and that kind of thing. The Greeks thought the Persian ladies were very desirable, very very sexy. Some enthusiastic about their lovemaking.
I guess if you can't see the guy's ears, obviously their hair was, I guess, bushy and long,
the headgear they wore as well. So the face is visible.
Yeah. What type of headgear, no pun intended, were they wearing while they're having sex? I don't.
It's quite extraordinary. There's these you see these kind of gemstones that were carved by Greek artists, but working for Persian ones. And very often they've still got they wear things called the Persians call them tiara at the time, but a sort of like a turban like garment, but it kind of comes under your chin as well, and you see them having sexy times and wearing all sorts of things. Yes, they don't necessarily get totally naked for all of that.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of wearing socks nowadays.
But yeah, it is. The thing was that so what a rabbit hole we're going to. But yes, Persian slippers were the thing that they often actually kept their slippers on, these Persian slippers, and they became super sexy in Greece eventually. They were and there's a lovely bit in Aristophanes' comedy, The Lysistrata, later in the 5th century, where the women of Greece are trying to stop the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta by going on a sex strike, amongst other things. And Lysistrata, who is a sort of leader of this sort of no sex revolution, they're going to stop having sex to make the men make peace, and then everyone will go back to it. And she makes the Greek women swear an oath and it's all the things they're not going to do that are really sexy. And one of the things that they are not going to do is to point their Persian slippers at the ceiling.
Oh, there you go.
So there you go.
Hey, Dustin, I think we're probably going to need to edit that part out because I don't want to give modern women any ideas. withholding sex when they don't get their way, because believe me.
I don't know, but maybe you could get an endorsement deal from a Persian slipper manufacturer or something. You mean?
Yeah, we could use this as a commercial.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the Persians, their motto should have been make love, not war, because look what happened to them when they fought Greece. So they should have just stayed where they were and not, you know, crossed over.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Steve, so I got one more question. With all of your study and research that you've done on ancient Greece, have you found the ingredients for creating Greek fire?
Oh, good question. That's another
That's a great question. It's a bit out of my period. Greek fire is a later thing. It's a kind of as far as I'm aware, it's a Byzantine creation. So it's a bit later than the Persian wars that I've been involved with. But I know that some and I can't quote you that, but I know that some experimental archaeology has been done on it, because I had a colleague who was at Birmingham University who got involved in some kind of experimental archaeology projects on that kind of thing, and it's certainly possible to make it happen, but it's some kind of flamethrower, but I'm not entirely sure what it is. I think it might involve sort of the superheating of olive oil or something like that, and then finding some way of igniting a spray of it. But I'm not sure. But probably if you rummage around, you will find some kind of experimental archaeology projects with people making Greek fire and doing dangerous things.
Yeah.
Brutally effective.
There was a guy, I don't know if I'm pronouncing, is it Archimedes or someone? He died at Syracuse by the Romans. He had lasers.
That's right. Yeah, Archimedes was cool. I mean, he was, he was helping to, defend Syracuse against the Romans. And one of the things that's credited to him is of using, sort of what were probably highly polished mirrors to focus the sun's rays onto ships and set light to them. It's quite how practical that is, I'm not sure, but it's accredited to him. You got to love Archimedes. He's great.
Yeah, very cool guy. Very cool. Well, Steve, this was a really fantastic conversation. There's so much to the world of the ancient Greeks that is still to this day so fascinating and obviously inspirational. To which you note in your book at the end where inspiration is still being had from these great battles 2,500 years later. And so it still impacts us today. And that's a bit of, that's the reason why we do this show, is because we like to talk about how history continues to impact us, every day. So, great work, great book. And thank you again for being on the show.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I really enjoyed the chat. So thank you for having me.
You got it.
Wow. That was an earful. I'm glad we got the opportunity to talk to this guy. And so he's a professor at Oxford. That's and he's a guest on our show. That's a great honor. I've always wanted to find out about the Magi and Croesus and some of the other stories. Now had the opportunity to actually ask somebody who's right there in the thick of the battle. So they would say to get that information. It bothers me. I don't know if you saw, there was some guy that was asking these college students on December the 7th, what happened, what happened 81 years ago, and nobody could guess Pearl Harbor, nobody.
Yeah.
So, and it's just as tragic that if we don't learn our roots, we always say that Western civilization, some of the stuff that we learned from, Jerusalem, Rome, but Greece, and Athens, and it's very important that we that you know, we know the classics, we know a little bit about classical education, which is what set, you know, our founding fathers apart from some of the founding fathers of, say, the Soviet Union and some other places. You know, they learned from the mistakes that were made with democracy. And, you know, he touches on the on democracy. He touches on the forms of government. He touches on the wars, the Greek-Persian wars, the history of Greece, the history of Persia. It's an interesting read. And
it's a good read. And I don't want to say that it's a brief guide like a lot of the books that he's written, but it is sort, and it's not a crash course. I mean, it's thorough. So if somebody is wanting to learn about what all was during that time, like the Persian and the Greeks going at it, it's an ideal book to have. It's an easy read. And I don't want to go so far as to say it's a necessary read, as far as, you know, it will, but you will understand the world much better. So in a way, I guess, it is a necessary read.
Well, and you know, when you watch the movie 300, I don't think they really explain why Xerxes was invading Greece.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and you know, it's because of what happened at Marathon. But then, okay, well, why did King Darius invade at Marathon? Well, there was a reason for that also. So, and it's an interesting read. You can go beyond just the United States and our history to go back. You know, ancient Persia has, you know, especially if you're into the Bible, because ancient Persia, yeah. Babylon, all that, there, it's all in the Old Testament.
Yeah, exactly. So. It all ties in, you know, and Darius and Xerxes, you know, are mentioned in the Bible, Darius more than I think anybody. So we don't have the segment music. Maybe we do it on our own. Do you want to do that?
What, sing?
No. So when I say, let's do This Week in History, you can be like, bam, 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 bam.
Well, I wasn't ready, but I'm not going to, because if I ever run for office later on, you know,
you're an idiot. Yeah.
Although I think I've said enough on this show to keep me from ever winning.
Yeah. And I think, you know, about politics enough to keep you from running as well. So yeah, all right. This Week in History. I'm not going to do the music. I'm just going to go ahead and get started. So December 13th, 1937. So last episode, before this one, last episode, we talked to Barrett Tillman on what was going on at the end of World War II in the Pacific. And this is sort of timely with that. So December 1st, you have the Battle of Nanking that takes place. But before all that, so the hostilities of World War II, we discussed this on the show with Barrett, how really people need to understand that World War II, the hostilities of World War II began in the Pacific with Japan trying to expand and with their battle with the Chinese. So instead of Europe, it takes place in the Pacific with the Second Sino-Japanese War, which started in 1937, but it started in July of 1937. And as is noted, the Marco Polo Bridge outside of Beijing. If you've never heard about the Marco Polo Bridge incident, it would be good to learn about that. And speaking of like very avoidable conflicts, that is one of them. Or making a mountain out of a molehill, if you will. And that is one of them. But I think it just comes down to, we want to take over this area and we just need a reason to start fighting. So as I noted, the Battle of Nanking starts December 1st, 1937. The Japanese took the capital, Nanking, the capital of the Republic of China. And on December 13th, they got into the city, and this became what is now known as the Rape of Nanking, which was about 6 weeks worth of just beating and raping and killing indiscriminately about 200,000 Chinese people. So interestingly, as we noted, the Second World War needs to be credited as beginning in the Pacific. It ends in the Pacific, as well. So when World War II ended, so did the Second Sino-Japanese War.
Very interesting. Yeah, I don't understand why they don't say World War II started in July, but
yeah,
I don't know. You know, the Soviets and the Japanese fought, you know, during that time.
The Russo-Japanese. Yeah.
No. Well, that was 1905. There was Soviets.
What did you say?
I said the Soviets.
And who?
The Soviets and the Japanese. They fought. And I believe they had a truce, or they stopped fighting at a peace agreement on September 16.
It's a few days after. Yeah. And so that's what they note as the end of World War II, right?
Yeah, and it was between the Soviets and the Japanese, and immediately, like the very next day, Joseph Stalin and the Soviets invaded Poland.
Yeah.
Which the Germans had invaded 2 weeks prior. So that was kind of an interesting thing. Now, my This Week in History is in 1945. It started on December the 16th. It's known as the Battle of the Bulge. Now, after D-Day, you had what was known as Operation Market Garden, which was the attempt to capture all these bridges that crossed the Rhine into Germany and hopefully end the war by Christmas. So that didn't quite work out that way. Probably the most important bridge, Arnhem, which was across the Rhine, they couldn't capture it. So it was a bridge too far, as they said. So that kind of slowed everything down, and we lost a lot of resources. We lost a lot of men. So it was delayed. Now, a lot of men, a lot of Americans that needed time out, that were pooped, that were fatigued, they were stationed in the Ardennes Forest, which is in Belgium and in Luxembourg. So they thought that would be a nice quiet sector. Further south and further north, there was a lot of fighting going on between the Allies and the Germans. Well, on December the 16th, the Germans sent about 400,000 men, several Panzer armies. They concentrated in the Ardennes Forest, and it was a sneak attack. The goal was to go all the way to Antwerp, capture Antwerp, and cut the Allies in two, like they did 4 years earlier, when the British and the French had to escape from via Dunkirk, and that was really what the plan was. Now the 82nd and 101st Airborne, they were immediately deployed into action to try to, because our guys were getting beaten back, and this bulge was created as the Germans were aiming towards Antwerp. That's how the name Battle of the Bulge came out. So our guys, Eisenhower, he deployed the 82nd and 101st Airborne to try to stop them. There was one little town called Bastogne, which was very important because it was kind of like a hub. There were about six or seven roads that intersected right in that town. And if you captured Bastogne, you can go in any direction. So 101st Airborne was deployed all around. They formed a perimeter so that the Germans couldn't capture the city. The Germans ended up going around. And, the Germans demanded a surrender. Now, the commander there was Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe. When he got the surrender demands, he replied with nuts. That's it, just nuts. And it became quite famous. Now, Eisenhower had a meeting with his top generals, and they're like, look, this looks like a big offensive. What can we do? How are we going to stop this? Patton said, I can get my men maneuvered and head north within 48 hours, which was unheard of. But Patton knew that the Germans were going to try to pull something. So within 48 hours, his Third Army raced northwards. And our guys in Bastogne wanted to be relieved by December, by Christmas. They weren't. They were relieved the following day. But from that area in Bastogne, they used kind of a pincer movement where they went north and our guys with the British came southwards. And what they did was they kind of closed a gap so that the Germans that were far to the west were trapped, and they knew they were about to be trapped. So a lot of them turned around and got the hell out of there, but many of the Germans didn't. They got stuck behind. The Germans were short on fuel, but the weather was really bad. It was cold, really cold. I mean, you know, some of our guys were getting frostbitten. They were outside in foxholes. Now, it just was not a good scene. If you ever think, wow, you know, like when Texas froze over, about 2 years ago, these guys were sitting outside. It was that bad. So there were a couple of massacres to talk about. The Malmedy massacre, we had about 84 of our men that were massacred. They were members of the 285th Field Artillery Observation Battalion. And then there was another one called the Wareth 11. These were Black soldiers, Black American soldiers that were murdered. They were part of the 333rd Field Artillery Battalion. They don't get enough attention, and that's unfortunate. So we're telling you, the Wareth 11, read about them. One of the biggest battles in American history. It was the largest battle for the Army, at least in World War II. We lost 19,000 killed, about 89,000 casualties overall. But that was the end of the German army in the West in terms of offensive capabilities. They gave it their all. They lost January 16th. The Pinscher movement closed, and then the war, and then the battle was over about 12 days later.
Yeah, crazy. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is This Week in History. Bum, bum, bum. All right. You're welcome. I guess we'll just slide right into our book and movie recommendations. Bing, 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 whatever. Music, just play it in your head. Obviously, the book is going to be The Harvest of War by our good friend over at Oxford, Steve Kershaw. We've built it up enough. Hopefully you will go get it, especially if you want to know about those battles and ancient Greece and a bit of ancient Persia, but are not willing to read some of the classics. So please go get that. Movie recommendations. I'm going to go 300. I'm going to throw that in there. I know it's one of your recommendations too, Alan, but you'll live. It's a pretty cool film. Don't take any of it to heart as far as, you know, factual based, you know, the names are pretty right. At least the king, and Xerxes. So I watched this the other night. I was trying to watch another film and I ended up watching this, Spirited. It's the new Christmas film with Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds. It's like a musical, and it's like a combination of A Christmas Carol musical but modern day. It was good. It was better than I anticipated, and actually with Ryan Reynolds in it and Will Ferrell, it was actually cleaner than I anticipated. So ladies and gentlemen, if you're looking for a new Christmas film to watch this year, go watch Spirited. I think it's an Apple production. So
All right. Well, the 300, funny that you mentioned that. 300 was not that inaccurate. I mean, it had a lot of accuracies in it, but I mean, it was based off a comic book. But hey, you know what? It's still pretty good. And if you read, I'm going to recommend The Harvest of War by Stephen Kershaw also. I'm going to say it's a very important book to read if you want to know about Western civilization. Now, if you want to go a little bit further, I was going to recommend Herodotus, but I think you can read Stephen Kershaw's book in place of it if you don't want a little heavy read. Yeah. But if you do want to read a heavy read, yes, then read Herodotus afterwards. But read The Harvest of War. You're going to get a lot out of it. Now, if you want to move on with some other stories, Thucydides, The Peloponnesian War, History of the Peloponnesian War, and there's a guy named Xenophon, he wrote, there are two books that I'm going to recommend. They're called Hellenica and Anabasis, but the English terms for it is going to be The March of the 10,000, which is an adventure story where where the Greeks are, you know, have the 10,000 mercenaries that are trapped in the middle of present day Iraq. Their Persian to be leader gets killed and they have to turn around and escape. And, you know, it's like a gauntlet of fire just to get back home. And then you have History of My Times. The history of the Peloponnesian War ends about 11 years before the war ends, or because the guy dies, Thucydides dies before he could finish the story. Xenophon kind of goes on and finishes the story of the Peloponnesian War. And then he talks about all these other wars that took place in Greece. So, you know, Xenophon, have a go at that. Now, movies. I like 300. I also like 300 Rise of an Empire, which shows the Battle of Salamis. Again, they're not 100% historically accurate, but you kind of get the idea. It was also 300 Spartans, which came out in 1962. And then you had a few other movies, Jason and the Argonauts. You had Troy, Helen of Troy, Three Stooges meets Hercules.
Hello.
Hercules meets the Moon Men. Yeah. Now, in 1979, there was a movie called Warriors or The Warriors. Okay, yeah. That's the one where the guy did the bottles. Now, warriors, come out and play. Well, yeah. The Warriors was based on the 10,000, the 10,000, what is it, of Xenophon, the 10,000, yeah. March of the 10,000, whatever you want to call it, Anabasis. That's what The Warriors is based on. So you have kind of a modern take where their leader gets killed and now they have to go through a gauntlet to get back home to Coney Island. So. Anyway, you got plenty of movies to watch. And
let me ask you a question, because I've not seen it. Warriors, is it good?
Yes, it is good. It's dated. It's a dated movie, obviously, but yeah, watch it. It's entertaining. It's a good movie. You see these guys, this came out in 1979. I mean, I remember when it came out because we wanted to watch it, but we were too young. I mean, you know, I think I was in middle school or something when that movie came out. So my folks were not going to let us go watch it.
Yeah, no, yeah. It wasn't The Crying Game, so they're not going to let you watch it.
Yeah, no. You know, listen, we had a hell, yeah, Crying Game. We had a hell, well, this was post that movie that we saw with Steve Austin, whatever his name is, Lee Majors, where he played the Norseman. I think it was called The Norseman.
Yeah.
But we had a hell of a time just to go see Escape from Alcatraz. Clint Eastwood, because it was a rated PG movie. So there's no, yeah, parental guidance. He didn't realize the suggested part. This is my dad. So there was no way in hell we were going to see an R-rated movie.
Yeah, no, good luck with that. So,
yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, hey, Alan, you did want me to remind you about something Christmas related.
Yeah. I just, you know, listen, I just want to say I'm grateful to have you. As my business partner, I have to emphasize that, yep. You know, Merry Christmas to you. Merry Christmas to your family. Your father had a close one last year and, you know, I thank God that was not his last Christmas. So, it's bittersweet when our season ends, but I've enjoyed the season very much and I look forward to season 5.
Yeah. Me too. Same here. The show would not go on if you were not here. So I really enjoy doing the show with you. It's always fun and it's great to have the guest on, but it's not that, yeah, I wouldn't want to do it if it was just me doing it. So
they wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for you. So there you go.
Yeah. So we need each other, right? Or in the words of your favorite film, you can't quit me, more or less.
Wait, where is that from? Oh, no. Oh, hell no. Hell no. No, 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 no. No. You know, I bet you that movie is probably going to be canceled because it's not woke enough.
Yeah. Well, look. Never mind. I don't want, no pun intended, but yeah. I don't want to get on that. So, yeah.
Yeah, all no right. pun intended.
Well,
all right.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is it for the show, and that is it for the season. We hope that you've had a good time. We will see y'all again sometime next year. I haven't put together the schedule yet, haven't put together when we're going to get started, but it will probably be somewhere around March, end of March, mid to end of March is probably when we're going to get back in the studio. So I am signing off from New York City, and I wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, and everything else. So you got anything else?
Yeah, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy Saturnalia, or whatever the hell they call it.
Yeah,
for all our pagan friends.
We've got a few, I'm sure. Yeah, don't go out and buy any Balenciaga or whatever that crazy thing was.
So yeah, well, the way things going, people will. So you know.
Yeah.
Let's enjoy things as they are now before it's all over.
All right, man. I'll see you later.
All right. Take care. Godspeed with you, buddy.
All right. Y'all have a good one.